So tonight, again, it's the Vegetarian Myth with Lair Keith. And I'll just go through what it's basically about before handing the show over to Lair. And again, thank you for coming. So we've been told that, and again, the shoe isn't taking a stance on this one way or the other, but we figure this is a good discussion to have. So the book is about, we've been told that a vegetarian diet can feed the hungry, honor the animals, and save the planet. Lair Keith believed in that plan and based that plant-based diet and spent 20 years as a vegan, but in the Vegetarian Myth, she argues that we've been led astray. Not your longing for a just and sustainable world, but our ignorance. The truth is that agriculture is a relentless assault against the planet, and most of the more of the same will not save us. In service to annual grains, humans have devastated prairies, forests, and driven countless species extinct, altered the climate, and destroyed the topsoil, the basis of life itself. Keith argues that if we're to save this planet, our food must be an act of profound and abiding repair. It must come from inside living communities and not be imposed upon them. So that's a little bit about what it's about. We have them for sale up there, so if you haven't read it yet, you ought to pick it up. Without further ado, take away and thank you for coming today.
So thank you for having me at your great bookstore. I'm so impressed that for 32 years this place has run on volunteers only. I think that's amazing. So, okay, I know half of you are thinking, she wrote a book against vegetarianism. You can't be against vegetarians. That's like being against old growth forests and baby bunnies. Who would publish this book?
Voldemort.
So I need to start by saying that I was a vegan for almost 20 years. I was a teenage vegan. I've been inside that world as deeply as one can be. I also did permanent damage to my body, which was the only thing that would have shaken me loose. When you are a vegan, it's not just what you eat, it's who you are. And I know that. So I know what it's costing some of you to be here tonight, and I really thank you for coming. I also want to be very clear that the underlying values of vegetarianism are not at issue here. So justice, sustainability, compassion, any questioning of human hubris or human entitlement, those are the guiding values of my life, and they are the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need. So this is not a problem with values. It is a problem with information. Even on the farthest fringes of the environmental movement, no one is questioning agriculture. So this is a profound cultural ignorance about the nature of nature as opposed to the nature of agriculture. So even the environmental movement isn't questioning agriculture. They don't know how, and they don't know if they should. So I'm asking for a lot in the next 30 minutes, because this is pretty big stuff, and it's mostly going to be new to you. So thank you in advance for trying. Okay, so the nature of nature and the nature of agriculture. I will cut right to the punchline. One is a war against the other. So you have to understand what agriculture actually is. You take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So it's flat out a cleansing. And this lets the human population grow to rather extraordinary numbers because you're not sharing the land. For a typical hunter-gatherer in this climate, it would take about 1 square mile to provide for basic needs. For a typical agriculturalist, maybe an acre or two, and it's because you're not sharing it. So besides the fact that you've permanently displaced any number of species, and displaced is a nice word for extinction, the other big problem is that we're destroying the topsoil. Soil is the basis of life, or at least terrestrial life. We owe our entire existence to 6 inches of topsoil and the fact that it rains. So right about now, if you're following this, you should be getting the cold chill of horror up the back of your neck. Except for the last remaining 46 tribes of hunter-gatherers, the human race has made itself dependent on an activity that is killing the planet. Lauren Cordain, who's an expert on Paleolithic nutrition, says, "We have wandered down a path toward absolute dependence on cereal grains, a path for which there is no return." That's because 80% of the calories that feed the human population come from those cereal grains. And in the getting of those calories, Well, 98% of the prairie is gone, and 99% of the topsoil in the Midwest is gone. That's because it's not a prairie anymore. When it was a prairie, it was building topsoil. That's what prairies do. So what we are utterly dependent on now is the destruction of our planet. So that's what I mean about the cold chill of horror. Insert moment of humor. When I was writing this book, I had this great moment where on the New York Times bestseller list, there was Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma and Barbara Kingsolver's Animal Vegetable Miracle. And I thought, this is my moment. These people are talking about so many of the same things that I am, and people are really interested in us. They're asking much bigger questions, and I'm all excited. And I called my ex on the phone, and I was like, look at this. This is the moment for me to write this book. I could not have picked a better time. Yeah, and so my ex says to me, Lierre, those books are food for funny stories. Not everybody likes those books. Your book, it's food plus the apocalypse. Do you see the difference? Yeah. So, we're going to talk about food and the apocalypse. William Catton wrote a book called Overshoot, and it came out in 1984. It is more timely now than it was then. It's like one of those books everybody should be reading right now everywhere on the planet. So he's got two concepts in here. The first is drawdown, and the second is takeover. Now, takeover is the way that essentially evolution works. The sun is basic energy source for everything on the planet. And of course, plants are the people that learn to photosynthesize. So they take the sun, they turn it into essentially into biological, to life, into matter. And everybody else is sort of piggybacking on that one way or another. So you've got degraders who break it down, you've got consumers who eat it, everybody's sort of playing a role in this, but it really goes back to the sunshine, and that is the only source of energy that we have. So in evolution, you've got your niche. There's some way that you're capturing some of that energy for you and yours. Eventually, you're not so good at it anymore. Somebody else comes along who's better. They take over your niche. Okay, 98% of all the creatures that have ever existed are extinct. That's not immoral, it's just how it works. And in fact, it gives the whole system of life a lot of resilience because it means we can adapt to change. Okay? So in the end, it's a cooperative process, and the whole goal is to create more life. But in the meantime, some of us are going to die. So that's takeover. Okay? You're going to drop off, somebody else comes along, they do it better. That's called takeover. Now, a lot of people say that agriculture was takeover because we took over more and more and more and more niches until we covered entire ecosystems. We'll get into that in just a second. The other way that species increase their numbers is by drawdown. Now, I said that the sun is really the only source of energy. Well, that's true, but there's stored energy. Okay, so fossil fuel. It's called fossil because it's really old, and gas, oil, coal, it's, you know, underneath the crust of the earth. It's been stored there for, you know, millions of years, and humans figured out how to extract it and how to use it. And by doing that, we temporarily increase the carrying capacity of the planet for humans, but it's temporary. Why? Because those sources of energy are never going to come again. Okay? Like the little drops of oil don't get a birds and bees talk from the bigger drops of oil. They don't reproduce. Once they're gone, they're gone. And that's what nobody in this culture is wanting to deal with right now, is the fact that we've become dependent on this oil, and it will not come again. When it's gone, you know, this glut, this, you know, momentary glut of cheap consumer crap is over. But by using that stored energy, they're calling that drawdown, because we're drawing down what was stored. Okay, so they make this distinction, like the peak oil writers and the resource depletion people, 1800, because that's the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So around about the year 1800, people figure out how to extract the stored energy, how to start using it. So they call that drawdown, because we're drawing it down. About this, I don't agree with them. Something very profound happens in 1800. There's no question that the scale of the destruction is just, you know, explodes at that point. But the concept that I would like to introduce into this conversation is fossil soil. And I would say that the drawdown age actually begins at agriculture. What we have been drawing down ever since is fossil soil. So to give you an example, one season of plow cropping, so wheat, soy, corn, whatever, one season, you can destroy 2,000 years of soil. Now, it's true that soil builds, but it's at such a slow rate that, you know, it might as well be essentially non-renewable. And that's what we've been doing for the last 10,000 years. Now, I said that soil is the basis of life, but what does that mean? Well, soil is not just dirt, okay? It's not insensate, like crumbs of sand. It's alive, and it's animate past our wildest imagining. If you take one tablespoon of soil, there's over a million living creatures inside that tablespoon. And if you can picture a square meter, or just a box, There should be over 1,000 different species of animals inside that soil. And when we do agriculture, that's what we're destroying. Jared Diamond, who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel, he says that agriculture was the biggest mistake that the human race ever made. And I agree, and that's why. One of the reasons that this is so of such concern, I mean, besides the destruction, is that the environmentalists, who should be the people who are onto this, don't even identify it as a problem. I mean, we skinned the planet alive. Agriculture is actually the single most destructive human activity. Now, burning fossil fuel is about to outstrip that. So then it will be the second most destructive activity. Okay, we have drawdown, takeover, agriculture. Okay, we've got one more concept here before we can finish up. The perennial polyculture. So I'm going to break this down. First you have perennial, then you have polyculture. A perennial is a plant that lives a long time. An annual only lives for one growing season, but perennials live a lot longer. In fact, some of them can live for thousands of years. Because they live a long time, they make these really complex root systems. Annuals really only produce by seed, because they only live this really short time, so most of their energy, their reproductive energy, goes into making that big fat seed. But the perennials can reproduce in lots of different ways, and because they live a long time, you've got these really complicated root systems. Literally, that is the matrix that holds soil in place. Without those roots, the soil just washes away. The other half of perennial polyculture is polyculture. So as opposed to a monoculture or a monocrop, polyculture. And that means there's a lot of different plants doing this together. And they make these incredibly exquisite communities with each other. And they are giving and taking and using and helping and communicating. But what they're doing all together is creating more soil, which is to say more life. And they are all needed in their communities. So that's the phrase for the millennium. If this planet has any hope, it's because we've repaired the perennial polycultures. There's a bunch of different kinds. Once you get the concept, though, you'll see it everywhere. So you've got forests. You've got grasslands, in between there's savannas, wetlands, tundras. So those are your basic perennial polycultures in nature. But it's the same thing, it's lots of plants living all together, making this huge entangled root system under the soil, and working as one community to create more life. And this is why so many indigenous cultures have a concept of plants as either our elders or our grandparents, because they created the soil, and then they created the oxygen-rich atmosphere that makes life possible. So they made this planet be a cradle for us. And, you know, how have we repaid them? So remember what agriculture is. You rip down the forest, you plow up the prairie, and you plant it to human use. You destroy the perennial polyculture. And what you plant instead are annual monocrops. If you've ever driven through Nebraska or Iowa, it's one plant for hundreds of miles, usually corn, wheat, whatever. But it's one plant, and it's an annual. It's only going to live for that one season. The best analogy I have for this is it's like if you cut yourself, that's the disaster, okay? The planet does not want the soil to be bare. That is a biological disaster. So it's like if you cut yourself and then you put a Band-Aid over it to hold the skin together. Well, the Band-Aid is the annuals. They spring to life when the soil is cleared, and their purpose is to protect the soil. So, you know, they have their moment, which is that one bright season in the sun. They protect the soil for that one season. And that's like the Band-Aid over the wound. And then your skin knits back together. Well, that's the perennials coming back together and, you know, doing their root thing, holding the soil back in place. And then the annuals die out. They cannot compete against the perennials. But, you know, nature loves an opportunist. And they're like the first responders, essentially. That's what annuals do. The problem with agriculture, of course, is that the disaster has to happen over and over and over again to plant those crops. And it means that we are destroying, actively destroying the basis of life. Just like us, when the soil is exposed, it dies. So the sunlight cooks it, and the rain compacts it, and the wind blows it to dust. So what I say is that agriculture is carnivorous. What it eats is entire ecosystems. So to state the obvious, no culture that is destroying the basis of life can be called sustainable. Actually, it can only be called insane. Now this gets very strange, because the people who should care about this the most, the environmentalists, these are the very foods that are being promoted as the way to save the planet. It is, in fact, the way we've destroyed the planet. It's like we want to save the world without even knowing it. So agriculture has run through every continent, except Antarctica. But don't worry, we're going to get that one with global warming. It's also the beginning of militarism, and it's the beginning of slavery. In the seven centers where agriculture first developed, human culture follows the same pattern pretty quickly. It's called civilization. And to use a really basic definition, it's life of cities. That's just etymologically what it means. What it really means is that people are living in population densities that are too thick for the surrounding land base to support them. So they have to import their resources. It requires the importation of goods. So this is the beginning of overshoots, because if your local land isn't supporting you, it means that you're living at too dense a population, but you have to keep reaching out to get more and more and more. And here's a quote from Clinton Callahan. Since the dawn of civilization, this pattern repeats itself over and over again. Civilization is largely the creation of psychopaths. All civilizations, our own included, have been built on slavery and mass murder. Psychopaths have played a disproportionate role in the development of civilization because they are hardwired to lie, kill, cheat, steal, torture, manipulate, and generally inflict great suffering without feeling any remorse. So the pattern of civilization is a bloated power center surrounded by colonies, and there are always colonies. The power center takes what it wants. Eventually the whole thing collapses because they run out, and then the whole thing starts over again somewhere else. So this is the pattern we've been on for about 10,000 years now. So agricultural societies end up militarized for three reasons. The first is, it's the surplus. Agriculture creates a surplus. But if the surplus can be stored, it can also be stolen, and you need somebody to guard it. Those people would be called soldiers. The second reason is imperialism. If you've used up what's in your land base, you're now going to have to go out and gather it up from other people. Nobody willingly gives up their land, their soil, their trees, their water, their metal. So you've got to have people whose job, permanent job, is to go out and collect that stuff, bring it into the power center. Again, those people are called soldiers. Agriculture makes that possible, because by creating that surplus, it means you can have different classes in society doing different jobs. Not everybody's required to grow food anymore. So by making it possible, it also makes it inevitable, because of course you're using up your land as you do that. So, we're supposed to turn our swords into plowshares, and the problem is that the plowshare has done way more damage than the sword ever will. And once you've got the one, you will always need the other. And the third problem is slavery. Some of the resources that soldiers take are, of course, other human beings. Agriculture is backbreaking labor. The average hunter-gatherer works about 17 hours a week to provide for her basic needs. Farmers, it's dawn to dusk. And for anyone to have any leisure time means that most people are going to have to live in some form of slavery. Like Athens, ancient Athens, the great birthplace of Western democracy, 90% of the population was enslaved. Now, we've lost the cultural memory of this because we've been using fossil fuel instead for about 150 years. But if the energy used by the average American to support the way that we live had to be provided by human beings, we would each have 300 slaves. So once you have huge numbers of the population in slavery, you're going to need somebody to keep them there. Well, again, that's the soldiers. And this is the cycle we've been on for 10,000 years. By the year 1800, when the fossil fuel age really began, three-quarters of everybody on this planet lived in some form of slavery, indenture, or serfdom. So the only reason we've forgotten this is because we're using machines, but I guarantee you when the oil starts to run out, we are going to remember how much work is involved. So that's the feedback loop, where agriculture creates the need for military, it creates the possibility for the military, and then you keep having to expand outward to get what you need. That used to be limited by supply lines. You could only get so far using horses and human foot power. So the Roman Empire was only going to get so big. Eventually, it was about to collapse just from distance alone. You cannot run a military empire, past a certain distance if all you've got is soldiers. With the invention, of course, of the internal combustion engine, all bets were off. And now you've got literally 200 corporations control 80% of the world economy. So there's this tiny little group of people who could probably fit in this room, control everything, beyond the wildest dreams of Julius Caesar. I mean, that's what this all of this has created. It's the most intense hierarchy that anybody could have ever predicted. And then the whole thing starts all over again. So there aren't any new continents. Atlantis is not waiting to be discovered. By the year 1950, this planet was at its topsoil. So agriculture had pretty much run its trajectory at that point. And there should have been a natural correction to this population, the overshoot that we were on. What happened instead was the Green Revolution. A man named Fritz Haber developed the Haber-Bosch process. He wanted fuel to thrive. He actually did it for the war machine in Germany. It's a long story that is poignant in so many ways, but you know, in the end, what it meant was there's a usable source of nitrogen that could be created from fossil fuel. So since 1950, that's what we've been eating as fossil fuel. Richard Manning says, with the possible exception of the domestication of wheat, the Green Revolution is the worst thing that has ever happened to the planet. And he says that because instead of the correction that should have happened in the 50s, what happened instead was we started eating fossil fuel and our population quadrupled. Now the crash is still inevitable. We are going to run out of the fossil fuel, but now it's going to be four times worse. Now at this point, if you're eating grain, you're eating fossil fuel in stock. It takes the equivalent of 3 to 4 tons of TNT per acre for a modern American farm. Iowa alone uses 4,000 Nagasaki bombs every year in terms of energy. When I talk about this being a war against the planet, it's not a metaphor. It's pretty direct. So by definition, this is not going to be sustainable. What the planet needs is not more of the same. And that's at the very center of why the political vegetarians are wrong. It doesn't really matter how noble our goals are, and they are certainly honorable. Destroying the basis of life itself is not going to save us at this point. And the only reason we don't understand that is because we're essentially urban industrialists. We really have no idea how our food is produced, where it comes from, and what the inputs are. And we don't know what it looks like when we're done with it. And this is really my favorite Derek Jensen quote, where he says, "Forests precede us, and deserts dog our heels." And that right there is the entire problem with the last 10,000 years. What our planet needs is for us to repair those perennial polycultures. The planet wants to be a forest. She wants her prairies back, and she definitely wants her wetlands back. If we simply get out of the way, those living communities will re-knit themselves into a resilient biotic collection of individuals that together make more life. We could also take our place as members of a soil-building community. Instead of being parasites, we could also make it happen faster. We could restore the prairie. We could replant the forest. We could bring the buffalo back. We could also take down every last dam and let the river come back to life. Ultimately, what we need to be eating is food that comes from within those living communities, not the food that's imposed across them. That's what we ate for the first 4 million years. I mean, we participated. And it's only for the last 10,000 that we've turned into monsters. So one of the reasons that I became a vegan was because I wanted my life to be possible without death. And I wanted it so badly that I was willing to eat some fairly disgusting food sometimes, and also to damage my body. What I didn't understand was that a prairie without ruminants will turn to desert, and that ruminants without wolves will also turn the prairie to desert, and that ultimately the prairie needs to eat the wolves too, and that we were all in this together, that we were all members of a tribe called Carbon, and that it was just points on a cycle. That to me was a moment of grace, and it helped a lot. The realization that the soil eats us all, that we could always go home. That knowledge and all its beauty and pain should be like ground zero for every culture. I should have known that by the time I was 4. But who was there left to tell us? And isn't everything that's wrong with this culture embedded in that question? So this is way bigger than what's dead on your plate. You have to ask what died to get that food there. And in the case of agriculture, the answer is everything. When I look at my dinner, I want a full accounting. And it's accounting that goes way beyond the individual. I want to know about the entire species. I want to know about the bison and the salmon and the wolf. And I don't just want the numbers of dead and gone. I want them back. So these are our options. There's the death that's the part of the cycle of life, and then there's the death that's killing all life. So we can participate, or we can dominate, but there's not actually any way out. Edward Hyams makes the same distinction. He wrote his book in like 1940, I think. He's saying exactly the same thing. You know, 70 years later, it's like I'm repeating the same information, and the culture still isn't catching on. But he says we can be members of a soil community. We can participate in protecting and building more soil by taking our nourishment from inside of living communities that our planet naturally organizes. Or we can be soil parasites by doing agriculture. Okay, so at about this point, everybody wants to know, but what should I eat? And I have real hesitations about offering my advice on that. But if I don't tell you, you're going to ask, so we might as well get it over with. It's going to be different from region to region, obviously, because you have to know the place you live, and you have to know what it wants to look like. And then you have to think about, well, what should it look like here? What did it look like once? What would it like to look like again? And it's really hard as an individual to do that because, A, we've overshot so badly that it's almost impossible as an individual to do that. And B, we don't actually know what it should look like. It's been so long since the world looked like it was supposed to that in our minds we don't even know. I mean, I've driven across Indiana 4 times. I had no idea there was a swamp there once upon a time, and it wasn't even that long ago. It was swamp. There were 13,000 acres of swamp in Indiana. The Limber Lost, it was called. And they even have a state historic monument there. You can go and talk to them. There's no swamp. The poor woman who runs the place has to tell 25,000 people every year there is no swamp. It's gone. But, you know, 3 basic questions you can try to apply to your food. 1, does it build or destroy topsoil? And that is so basic. If you are not building topsoil, it needs to be removed from the human menu forever. 2, input. Is it just sunshine and ambient rain? Or is it fossil fuel and fossil water? I mean, there are these gigantic aquifers under all the major grain growings of the world. So the Oglala Aquifer, for instance, in the Midwest, absolutely pumped dry at this point. They're using oil drilling equipment to get to that water. Okay, like, it's over, people, you know? We have so overshot. So, yeah, you got the fossil fuel, the fossil water, or we're going to use ambient sun and ambient rain. I mean, it seems pretty obvious where we should be heading with this. And then the third thing is distance. There's this wonderful concept of your food shed, which is like your watershed. So how far could you walk in a day or two? That's your food shed. It's the area from which your food should come, and you have to know your food shed, and you have to love your food shed, and you've got to protect your food shed. We have to be part of our food shed once again. I mean, the other option is it comes from thousands of miles away. They say the average bite of food in America takes 10 times as many calories to get it to you than the 1 calorie you're going to get out of it. This is completely insane. You can buy frozen peas from China now. Who made this up, you know? So there's this river of oil called the Interstate Highway System. Obviously, that's never going to be sustainable. So topsoil, input, difference. I mean, those are, if you want to try to be, you know, as sustainable as you can as an individual, I would say those are the 3 things that matter the most. Okay, so on a personal level, we can try to make those kinds of choices. But until we face the twin problems of population and resource depletion, these are really just personal decisions. They're not going to have any kind of political impact. Like, the average American produces the same greenhouse gas emissions as 4.5 Mexicans, 18 Indians, 99 Bangladeshis. No rational person would believe that our finite planet can provide for this way of life for much longer. This is Richard Heinberg. There is an essential lesson here. If we want peace, democracy, and human rights, we must work to create the ecological conditions essential for those things to exist, i.e., a stable human population at or less than the environment's long-term carrying capacity. The longer we wait, the fewer our options. Social liberals and progressives who fail to talk openly about population and resources issues and to propose workable solutions are merely helping to create their own worst nightmare. To put this really bluntly, we need civilization to end, especially the industrial version, and we need to reduce our population dramatically and quickly. Now, honestly, we could do both of those things if, as a species, we would sit and think about it reasonably, and we could do it in a way that respects human rights. I see no evidence that we are on the verge of doing that, which does not give me a lot of hope for the future. The very creation myth of this culture is to go out and dominate, conquer, like go forth and multiply. No hunter-gatherer is told by her god to willfully overshoot her land base. And no reasonably sane person would listen to such a god. But that's what we have. I mean, this is the real Voldemort and Sons. We've got patriarchy, civilization, racism, capitalism. Okay? That is food plus the apocalypse. Now, faced with Voldemort, the environmental movement can only offer us personal lifestyle choices with a little moral exhortation. None of that is going to save the planet. To quote Andrew Dworkin, what we need is organized political resistance. The task of an activist is not to navigate systems of power with as much personal integrity as possible. It is to dismantle those systems. Personal consumer choices aren't going to disrupt global arrangements of power, and that's the problem. I usually come bearing chocolate because I rarely come bearing good news. The facts as they stand, our planet is dying. Actually, she's being drawn and quartered. 120 species go extinct every day. 98% of the old growth forests are gone. 99% of the prairies are gone. There's dioxin in every single mother's breast milk on this planet. There's now 10 times as much plastic as plankton in the ocean, and the phytoplankton populations are crashing. That is the bottom of the food chain, people. We're in big trouble. We're also out of time. And catastrophic climate change is here. If we were polar bears, we would know it was here. The average female polar bear now weighs 80 pounds less than she should. They're starving. So we really need to get over this concept of lifestyle politics and start thinking like a serious resistance movement. This is a war. And I know it feels like daily life because it's been going on for 10,000 years, but it's a war. Honestly, I think it's like fascist Nazis took over our country, and they were destroying 98% of the forest and driving 120 species extinct every day. We would know it was passed on to fight back. And I don't know why ExxonMobil and Cargill and Monsanto get a free pass, but it is definitely time to start thinking like a resistance movement that's brave and smart and militant and means it. We need warriors who will put themselves between what is left of our planet and fossil fuels. And if you're any one of a thousand legitimate reasons you can't be one of those warriors, fine. You can be part of a culture of resistance. Because a resistance movement always needs two things: loyalty and material support. Any of us can do that. This is the last moment to fight. If anyone is left alive 100 years from now, they are going to wonder, what the fuck was wrong with us that we didn't fight like hell when the planet was going down? Now you love something or you wouldn't be here tonight. Whatever you love is under assault. Love is a verb. We have to let that love call us to action.
Britain?
Moderator?
No, you don't.
No.
He can stay put. He can moderate from the beginning. Questions?
You were talking a lot about hunter-gatherers before, and so, I mean, the amount of hunter-gatherers is extremely variable depending on what continent we're talking
Absolutely.
About, all of that, ranging from maybe like a few dozen to, for example, the Hadza in Africa,
mm-hmm.
which has 200 about, and the land areas are very variable, and a lot of them are very extensive.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what my question is, how much of this problem is contingent just on population size? And not necessarily just agriculture. If all these populations were really small
mm-hmm.
globally, like they are then, and they had the same access to ranges and were only tilling fields in a more responsible way and really going, because seasonally, I mean, hunter-gatherers are going very
mm-hmm.
far
sure.
distances
yeah.
depending on what group we're talking about. So if agriculture was in more of that way, where lots of expense was happening and population numbers were really small, I mean,
honestly, if there were like 10 people on the planet, it wouldn't matter what we did. We wouldn't be able to hurt anything. The problem with agriculture is the fact that it's inherently destructive. It breaks the link between people and the land in such a way that the population keeps growing and growing and growing while the actual soil is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And it can take thousands of years before you see the damage. With a hunter-gatherer, if you overshoot, you know in a season that you took too much, and you're hungry immediately. So they're really good at keeping their populations under control. And not all of that is friendly. I mean, I would hate to have to do infanticide, but that's the fallback plan, you know, for hunter-gatherers. They want their populations to be small, and the linkage is very, very direct. It's within a season or two. If you overhunt, you know it, and you're all hungry. So they have all these things in places in their cultures about, well, this is exactly how what the ratio between adults and children has to be for us not to be hungry in a year or two. And they stick by it because they have to. With agriculture, it's totally different. The linkage is broken. So you're accumulating all the surplus, and the population just grows and grows and grows. It just explodes when you see agriculture. And that's why, because even as you're destroying things, you don't notice it yet because you're drawing down the soil. And then you're expanding, and you're taking over the range that used to belong to hunter-gatherers. I mean, that's the pattern historically. The only hunter-gatherers that are left now are in places that are just either too cold or too dry to do agriculture. It's the land that the agriculturists don't want. So you've got people above the Arctic Circle, you've got a couple people in really dry areas, and that's really it. The agriculturists have taken over everything. So it seems inevitable from history that the populations of the agriculturalists always explode. Another reason, of course, is that when you have those really soft foods that you can start feeding babies at a really young age, whereas with hunter-gatherers, women are usually breastfeeding so the kids are 4 or 5, so there's a more natural spacing of children. And also the fact that agriculture involves so much work. You want hands to do the field work. And with hunter-gatherers, you don't need people to do the work because it's really easy. So
basically you feel that you can do the contact with your cost efficiently at agriculture without having population explosion occur from that.
Well, it's never happened before. We'd have to have a really, really small population to be able to do that kind of destruction and let it heal up behind us. The kind of food systems that I think are sustainable, which are based on perennial polycultures, the planet might be able to support about 300 million people. Now we've got, like, what, 6-something billion. With what you're talking about, I would say it would probably be about a quarter of that, because you'd have to let that land heal up in a pretty profound way. Maybe once every 100 years or something, you could plow it. So it would have to be a lot, lot fewer people.
Okay,
so,
thank you.
Yeah. Who else? I've depressed them all. Yeah, guys?
I guess then humans would be the only example of, like, an animal that practices agriculture.
I would say yes. Other animals have a profound impact on their environment, but it's in ways that make the community stronger, not weaker. Like, for instance, beavers. I mean, a lot of times when you talk about dams, people get upset. Well, beavers build dams. Well, sure they do, and what they create is wetlands, which are the most species-dense habitat on the planet. They're creating, like, beautiful, dense kinds of habitat for other creatures to live in. And when we make dams, we leave deserts behind us, and we destroy rivers and destroy forests, and the whole riparian community just goes down when we build dams. So, yeah, sure, beavers absolutely have a huge impact. I mean, they're a keystone species like we are. But what follows them is more life. What follows us is just, you know, this horror of deserts. So, I mean, so by my definition of agriculture, yeah, we're the only ones that do that, because we're the only ones that do the annual monocrops. Other people have a different definition of agriculture. Like if you're talking about, like, sort of agroforestry systems, so the kinds of things that hunter-gatherers do where they use fire, they're certainly shifting species around. You know, they're some different plants, some different trees are more adapted to fire. They're going to, you know, by using fire, you're going to shift those out. You're going to bring in other kinds of species. But in the end, like, is it creating more life or is it creating less? And the way that most people have used fire creates more. People have done destructive things. I mean, I don't mean to, like, uphold hunter-gatherers as this, because, like, Australia was pretty well wrecked by the first people who got there. You know, I mean, there's other examples from kind of around, you know, the globe where you can say, well, yeah, that was kind of a destructive, stupid thing. But I feel like our only chance is perennial polyculture. So it's not necessarily that we're going to get it right, but it's our only hope. So, and I would say, yes, we are the only ones that do agriculture. That doesn't mean that other species don't have an impact, because we all have an impact on the place that we live. But really the question is it, are we leaving the place better than we found it, or are we trashing it? I mean, ultimately the question. So, back there, you had a question.
Yeah, what was the natural evolution of hunters and gatherers to plant, like, the cereal grain grass to feed animals so they wouldn't have to go and hunt anymore, but to raise them where they were in a stationary position instead of migrating? I mean, this is like 10,000 years ago we started planting grass, right?
The animals, okay, this is an interesting question, because there's a great big question mark over why did people ever take up agriculture? And in fact, Colin Tudge, who's an economist at the London School of Economics, has a really great quote where he says, well, the question isn't why did it take some people so long, why did anybody do it at all, since it's so obviously beastly. I just love that. So there's a very theory to why did people start doing this. All the places where agriculture began were places that were disturbed by flood a lot. So they're all floodplain valleys. And those are places where annuals have their moment a lot, because the flood is creating this constant disturbance, and so the annuals are always, you know, sort of waiting in the wings. Yeah, it's going to be another flood, let's do it. And then they pop up. So you have a lot more annuals in those places because there's so much natural disturbance. And so the seven places where agriculture began are those places of disturbance. They're in these river valleys. So from there, it's like, okay, so what happened next? You know, like, what I was taught in grade school was, well, the population got really big, and people had to figure out how to be clever, so they started to use their land more and more intensively, and that led to agriculture. It's not actually true. The archaeological record does not show that. If that was the case, people
would start shrinking and they would start getting diseases, and you would see signs of starvation and hunger in their bones and in the remains that are left. They don't find that anywhere. So that's the story we were told is not actually what happened. Nobody actually knows why people did this. Because again, it's backbreaking labor for piss poor nutrition. The only theory that I have ever seen that makes any sense, and some of the other people who talk about agriculture the way that I do, I mean, it's as a negative, this is a theory that's sort of going around at this point, is that it's addictive. The annual grains actually all contain opioids, and they click into the human brain. One of the very first plants that was ever domesticated was the poppy, and I can guarantee you nobody is eating those little tiny seeds for a meal, you know. Only one reason. And there's other animals, actually, that do addictive behaviors, like goats, for instance. There's a kind of lichen that gives them a high, and they will literally chew their teeth down to the gums, getting that lichen off the rock. Cows will eat local weed until they literally go crazy. Reindeer will eat these psychedelic mushrooms, the agaricus mushrooms. Like, they'll drive themselves off cliffs, like, having crazy high. Ducks and geese will eat fermented berries until they're flying drunk, and they'll die from it. I mean, there's like all these examples in the animal world of animals getting addicted, doing incredibly self-destructive things. Anything that has a brain can get addicted. I mean, it's like you've got the pleasure centers. And there are opioids in every single one of the annual grains. And it's a lower dose, obviously, than an opium poppy. But some people think that's the only reason. It's the only thing that makes sense if we got addicted. So I don't know. The normal diet of the kinds of ruminants you're talking about is not grain. That's only been done for the last 50 years. What they eat is grass. That's what their stomachs are designed for. If you feed them grain, they die because it's too acid. Grass is actually quite neutral, and if you feed them grain, it actually kills the bacteria, which is how we've ended up with, you know, all these problems in the food supply with, you know, various evil things that will kill you. But it's because they feed them grain, and that only happened because of the Green Revolution. This was a huge surplus of corn, and nowhere else to go. So anyway, we don't really know why people started doing it. I mean, I like the addiction theory because it works in my life. Like, I actually don't keep wheat in my house because I can't stop eating it once I start. So it's like, I know what this feels like. I don't know that that's true for everybody, but I think it's true for enough people that it makes sense to me because I don't know why else you would do it. Hunter-gathering is so easy. You basically lie around the sun, take a lot of naps, gossip, sing. Oh, and once in a while, go pick something. I mean, it's an easy life, you know. Agriculture? You start at 6 in the morning, you're not done till late at night, and people get smaller and smaller and smaller, and their bones get more and more and more riddled with disease from the archaeological record. So, I have book lists if you want to read some of these fun books I'm referring to. I brought, you can also read my book, but that's okay, I'm not just here to plug me. Here, further reading. You can have one. Okay, who else?
Okay. Well, a lot of the other things, though, a lot of the ethnographic studies show that also in very arid environments that digging for a lot of tubers and things like that or is often a main form of sustenance because there's not a lot of fruit and a lot of really high energy things like that. And a lot of these digging for roots, a lot of children need to be trained really, really intensively, and a lot of people don't hit their curve until their late 20s, mid-30s.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of elderly can't do this.
Right.
That it can take an extensively long time to dig these things up.
Mm-hmm.
And additionally, even if you actually get it, if you're lucky enough to get some of these underground storage organs, I mean, the actual processing can
right.
be really difficult. A lot of grinding.
Right.
A lot of people will actually stick it in their mouth for extensive periods of time because they can make a wad just to swallow the thing,
mm-hmm.
Especially if you don't have access to a lot of materials in order to make fire and roast and things like that. And so I really question the figure that hunter-gatherers are only spending 17 hours of work. And by work, I'm assuming that you mean specifically gathering food sources, not in addition to taking care of children or gaining materials for housing or any other such things like that. Where did you get your references?
Oh gosh, that's R.B. Lee. That's like the famous study that they did from the ethnography. R.B. Lee. This like people have been quoting this one for 30 years. He did this in the 60s where he added it all up. And it's this huge, it's like the encyclopedia of, what is it even called? The encyclopedia of human something. I'm trying to remember this. You know what? If somebody hands me a copy of my book, I can find this record. Or give me your email address, I can send it to you.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot of like the digging stuff, those people have been pushed onto really, really marginal land. With that level of processing, they wouldn't have had that technology 4 million years ago. So they're only doing that now because the agriculture is getting the better land. Okay, so they're digging that. But, you know, a lot of that land was destroyed when the first hunter-gatherers came because they used fire in a way that that land was never prepared for. So it was much more heavily forested, and now it's like shrub and scrub stuff. And it's because they did this terrible damage to Australia and New Zealand, was the same thing. It was just too dry of a continent. And so a lot of, like, the taller of the trees and the sort of the mid-level of the canopy was, and also the megafauna, were completely wiped out by the first people who got there, the first few hundred years. And you can see there's like these layers of ash where they started doing the fire, and then they learned, because the ash layers get further and further apart, where it's like they're like, oh, wait a minute, we kind of wrecked everything, didn't we? And now it's actually really interesting, because a lot of the people, in order to light a fire there, you have to get like all these elders to say it's okay. So it got imprinted into their culture that, like, you know, this was something we did that was not necessarily so good, and we need to use this tool very, very carefully in terms of fire. So, but I'm going to find this reference for you.
There are a lot of references, I think, that would try to repeat that. I mean, specifically speaking to megafauna, additionally, in a lot of areas in Australia, Africa, North America, things like that where megafauna existed, I mean, there aren't areas where there are a lot of deposits of megafauna bones, and if we were seeing mass extinction, we would be seeing bones in such areas where you would see areas such as different processing sites that would have other archaeological artifacts. And I don't know that you can say that megafauna were necessarily taken out by humans. I think that's hotly debated. But
it is certainly. It's absolutely in North America. It's very hot. And I don't know what I think about North America. I do agree in Australia, though. I don't think there's any question that humans arrived. And, like, there were geese the size of Volkswagen. I mean, they're just, like, incredible bones, and humans arrive, and they're gone. They're just wiped out, you know, and it's the fire. There's no way they could have hand-hugged them all. There's no way this was done by hunting. But the fire remains are there, and it's just, you know. There's a whole book, actually, on Australia, which I think is called The Missing Animals of Australia, or The Missing Megafauna, and this was, like, the most recent, you know. Then, to me, it made sense. It's like, well, what did happen to them? And, like, the fire thing is like, yeah, well, you burned all their forests. What were they going to eat? And they all died, so. Okay, I got to find Irby Lee. So who else has a question? Go ahead. Fight over it.
So, is it possible to live in an urban setting such as the wonderful city of Philadelphia without relying on agriculture of some sort? Because, I mean, I'm fine with eating people. There's plenty
right.
of those around. But I don't know about, you know,
well,
how
we've,
many.
We've got this problem. I mean, this is like the corner we've backed ourselves into as a species. Like, we're stuck doing this activity, and this activity is killing the planet, and I don't have a great way out. Like, I didn't have children, you know, it was the best I could do, and I don't know what to tell you. Like, we need to reduce this population, and we need to do it fast, and we need to understand that certain activities just have to be removed from, you know, our palate of how we're going to get food, because it hasn't worked. No,
so
long term.
Which activities? I mean, should we move to a rural setting and just try to find something that's growing and eat it?
You know, there's like all kinds of, like, permaculture, for instance. You know, you can buy a nice little farm, you can try to make this beautiful little world, and you can do a great job at it and have a lot of fun. And when the crash comes, you're like the after-dinner snack for civilization. I mean, what has to stop is the destruction. Like, I don't really believe in the lifeboat concept. I think that we need to get active. And to stop, there are people in charge of this, and they are killing our planet, and they need to be stopped. And I think we can worry about the rest of it later. You know, it's like right now, like, there's like the psychopath with the axe standing over our bed, and like we can say, well, tomorrow how are we going to get food? But it's like right now, he's about to kill us. So what's the primary emergency? And to me, it's that the planet is dying. There's some people in charge. They're in fact making a lot of profit off it. My personal life decisions aren't really what's important here. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's more like kill the person over your bed and eat them and kill two birds with one stone.
Go for it. You can start with like the head of ExxonMobil. Okay, way back there.
When you speak about, I guess, thousands of years ago when humans would arrive on certain continents and wipe out species of plants and animals, how much of that can you attribute to just a species advantage that humans have, and how much can you attribute it to a human wrong, where they were being a bad animal and doing the wrong thing? Like, which is it? Like, where's the line that you
right.
can draw there? Because if a human comes and sets fire and destroys some plant or something, or destroys the soil, like, isn't that just like a human intelligence that is, it's in the grand scale of evolution, that is just surpassing another species, or is it actually a species that's doing something wrong and inappropriate and that's disrupting the cycle? Like, how can you say that something is disrupting the cycle when it may just be, like, a part of it? Like, maybe, I don't know, like, a rebirthing of that area.
Well, I think those are interesting things to consider. I think for me, it's not really compelling, because I don't really care. It's like, right now, this is this moment of really, it's just this terrible emergency across the planet, and I want it to stop. Like, I want my planet to survive. And there's no reason that humans can't think about what we're doing and try for something better. Like, if we see that we're being destructive, and there's no question that we're having this terrible impact, it doesn't really matter to me whether it's like a natural part of the species or not a natural part of the species. It's something we can stop. It's something we did. It's something we can stop doing. You know what?
And I guess that's just how I feel about non-human species. It's something that I've been stuck to. I'm just wondering, like, where, like, I guess I'm asking for that line. Like, where can I draw the line? And, like, what I'm doing is something that I don't like and I want to see stop? Or is it something that there is, like, how can you tell that what you're doing is actually better for the earth? If you're saying, like, you want it to just stop, like, it's similar to what a lot of people say when they don't want to eat animals, is they just would like to see killing stop, and that they feel that they're, like, more capable of living a different lifestyle, like you said, that doesn't involve death. Mm-hmm. So I guess.
Well, I think it's very honorable to not eat factory farmed meat, because it's a horror on every level. And I would never encourage anybody to participate in torture or the kind of destruction that goes on with that. But we've got to ask a deeper question about the food that's on your plate and everything that dies to get that food there. And if you're going to ask the larger equation, agriculture does not win. I mean, it's just been nothing but destruction for 10,000 years. And if you understand everything that's involved in producing food, like, you're going to end up making different decisions. That's what happened to me, you know? Because I didn't want it to be about death, but I had to accept, because I started growing my own food and I saw how much death was involved, you know, in my, you know, totally nonviolent, whatever, peaceful vegan world. It was like death, death, and more death. It was like, so what are my choices here? And in the end, it didn't end up being vegetarian, because I didn't see that agriculture was doing our planet any good. And it was one of the prime ways that we destroyed it. And we weren't even aware of it. I mean, that was like the heartbreak to me. I thought I was doing this really great thing. And I had no idea what the kinds of death that I was participating in, entire species. You know, not just individuals, but entire species. So, I don't know these questions about, like, what's natural, what's not natural. I mean, I just, you know, you can kind of spin yourself around on that one for a long time. We are animals. We have animal bodies. We have animal brains. And we need to accept those animals that we are. And so I don't know whether that answers your question about natural versus not natural.
Well, I also think, like, there's something beyond natural that we need to think about, which is what's just and what's sustainable. It doesn't really matter to me whether we decide something is natural or not. If we're killing the planet by doing it, we got to stop. And if we're creating massive amounts of injustice against other humans or other species, we have to stop. You know, and I see agriculture as those things, so they have to stop. Like that.
I guess I'm really, really shocked. I read like the first 14 pages that I could on the internet,
right.
And like I expected something that, and now it's like completely different. I think what really, really shocked me is just you're right. It's totally like an apocalyptic story, you know. And I keep working it out in my head, like, well, what do we do now, you know? Like, I guess, like, I immediately switch to, well, what course of action should I be taking with this information? And the only thing that really comes to mind is that, like, a lot of people are going to die, or maybe, I don't know how you're going to go about doing it. Either you're going to be preventing a lot of life, or like, a lot of people are going to be dying, and I'm sure you've played this scenario out in your head a whole lot. And I don't know, maybe you could share like what this looks like. You know, I want more gloom and doom, essentially.
Well, there's like my friend Eric talks about the three F's, which is fascism, fundamentalism, and feudalism. I'm very afraid of those things, because as the food does start to run out, people are going to want structure, and they're going to want easy answers, and they're going to gravitate to the alphas. And that's what people do when they're under stress. And I would really like it if we could gravitate in the other direction, which is towards human rights and some form of, you know, reasonable distribution of resources. But it means facing what we've done and how far we've overshot and reining that in. And it really means having like a profound 150% commitment to human rights to make that happen. And I just don't see a lot of evidence of it, and it's really terrifying. For me, it's like I don't tend to dwell on that as much, because I really want to see a resistance movement while there's still life. And that's really my focus, is, well, how are we going to make resistance to industrial civilization? Because I think that's the most compelling question of the day, while there is still something alive. I mean, if all that methane melts from under the permafrost, this planet will be hotter than Venus. And that's going to happen in the next 100 years. There will be nothing left. I mean, we will have done it then. It'll just be rock. I don't want that. I mean, I happen to love this planet an awful lot, and I want that resistance movement. So, to me, that's more what I think about. It's like, how are we going to make resistance? But, yeah, I mean, those scenarios, you know, The Handmaid's Tale, and, you know, every Blade Runner, like, what, you know, like, they're all there, you know? And it's bad. You know, I don't have any great... And the kinds of things that people revert to when they're under that kind of stress is not pretty. You know? So... And there's only so many bullets. I mean, we can all hole up in our little happy cabins with, you know, as many bullets as we can accumulate, but they're going to run out eventually. So this is why we'll kind of all win it together. It's like, if we can figure out how to make our communities strong enough in terms of democracy, human rights, food networks, local currencies, any of that stuff that I think would be part of a culture of resistance, we've got to do it. I mean, we're out of time. And we really need to inoculate people against, you know, the 3Fs.
Can we even... without, you know, like you mentioned, infanticide, or even like, I just can't foresee like even a successful resistance, you know, we are still like way past the carrying capacity.
I know.
Without agriculture, like something has to happen. Even like with the resistance, there's still going to be catastrophe. That's
true.
Like how I see it.
I know. I have no great ideas. We're like so far over the
question.
Yeah,
I know. That's a lot of pressure. Like,
I know.
Give me the solution. I
wish I had one for you. You know, I mean, there's certainly things we can do better, but they're all kind of band-aids. You know.
Yeah. Totally.
So it's like you got to. I guess just start local.
Yeah. I don't want to put that pressure on you.
Well, I mean, I wish I. It's the question people ask, and it's like,
right.
I wish I had the answer. All I can tell you is, make the culture of resistance where you live, and if you can do more, do more. Like, if you're somebody who can really be in a resistance movement, do it. You know. And if all you can do is the culture stuff, great, do that. You know, direct democracy, local food networks, local currency, those are the things that are going to matter. You know your neighbors, you know. Because the food's going to run out, especially in cities. And then what? Way in the back.
So I hope I'm not asking you to repeat anything. But, I guess I wanted to comment on what you were saying. I guess, like, I just get in a lot of fights with people, like, not aggressively, but I've always thought, like, two things are true. Like, there's so much more waste happening in buying, like, a block of tofu from Whole Foods than there is in, like, local organic free-range chicken. Like, it's not about what's right or wrong or natural or unnatural, but, like, because, I mean, I consider myself a vegan, you know, I am a vegan, but... I mean, you know, you're going to, like, plant the soy, and then pick the soy, and then process the soy, and then refrigerate the tofu, and then ship it to Whole Foods, and then buy it from Whole Foods, take it back to your house, put it in your refrigerator, and then cook it. It's like, there's so many things that are so destructive about that whole process. So I think, like, that was something I was thinking of when you were talking, was, I don't know, just, like, the impact that that has. The other thing is, I feel like we shouldn't live here. Like, I think that, and I don't know if you talked about this earlier, but I feel like maybe we should all be living, like, along the equator or somewhere where there's, like, plentiful food that's constantly available. Like, I mean, I'm just thinking of all the things that need to happen for me to live in Philadelphia. Like, my body can't actually handle the cold. Like, I need to heat my house. My body can't really handle the heat sometimes. Like, I need to cool my house. Like, just all of these things, like, need to happen. My food needs to be imported here. Like, I can't really eat all year round, you know, if I were to grow my own food even. So I don't know. I was just curious if you already talked about all of those things or your comments on that or other people's comments.
I didn't talk about that. I mean, I totally hear what you're saying. And I don't have a lot of great answers. It's like, yeah, I don't know what to tell you because we're universally concerned because the planet's dying. And all of that is really valid. And it's like, you know, in our day-to-day lives, we're going to choose what we choose. And it's like, okay, well, what is the compelling moral thing that I can do today? And those are great things to do, and they make us feel better. And there are certainly things to consider that are bigger philosophical questions. But I know that right now on the ground, my planet's being drawn a quarter. And that's the emergency that matters to me the most. I was like, what are we going to do about that? Because that has to stop before we can answer any of those other questions. I don't know if that helps. You should write a book.
Yeah, I mean, to me, like, I just started watching, like, talking about the end of oil.
Right.
And that made me think, okay, well, like, if we run out of oil, what are all the things that are going to happen? The biggest thing is people won't be shipped to urban areas.
Right.
By, like, 2050 or something, like, 50% of the world is supposed to live in an urban environment. So then, like, there, you know, the urban environment kind of implodes, and then, like, the suburbs try to, like, I don't know, go crazy because they can't drive to anywhere to get their food, and everyone dies, and then people who live in tropical areas boom. Like, that was my solution in my head.
It's going to be ugly, there's no question. I mean, the population has, across the globe, you know, it's risen and crashed, like, so many times, and it's hard to know what to suggest in terms of, like, how best to prepare for that personally, because it's, you know, and it's ugly each time. I mean, there aren't a lot of moments when, like, oh, and we sailed through it so wonderfully. Like, it just gets really ugly, you know? So, I don't know if you want to talk, Dad. Having lived through this once, this is my dad back here. He's lived through
this.
All I
can say is, in my lifetime, the population of this planet has more than tripled. That's crazy. It cannot keep going.
Well, he was a refugee in World War II, so he watched Europe collapse, half starved in refugee camps. And, you know, I mean, a lot of what I know about people starving comes from my father, because he's told me these, you know, personal history stories, and it ain't pretty. So, yeah. All right, who else? You had your hand up for a while.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk about population reduction, because, like, you touched on it a little bit, and you said something about how there are, like, actual concrete, like, viable ways to go about it. And, I don't know, there's, like, the whole thing about the massive die-off that needs to happen for the world to survive, and, like, some people are, like, a little too excited about it, because, like, it's mostly going to happen in places where people are marginalized, like Africa and stuff, like, it's already pretty much happening. So I was wondering if you could, like, talk about that.
I think the places that it's going to happen the most are in urban environments, both in wealthy countries and in poor countries. And, like, I don't take any glee in that. I wish there was a way out. And I don't know how to make it happen. It's like, I mean, I do know that the biggest factor in reducing population is to give women a good education. But if you empower women enough, the population naturally drops. Great, we should all be feminists. That's going to take a long time, though. We don't have that amount of time. And these are limits that I do not control. Like, it's not up to me. You know, it's like we're running out of fossil fuels. The planet is getting hotter. By the time it's, you know, 98 degrees, most of those grain crops stop growing anyway. So one way or another, there is going to be massive starvation in our lifetime. And, I mean, if I was Barack Obama, maybe I'd have more, you know, at my fingertips for things I could do. But it's like, I don't know what to tell you. It's going to be really horrible. And in some ways, like, the sooner it happens, the better, because the sooner we get, the more that's left alive is more for the system to reboot itself. Like, if it happens and there are still polar bears can come back. If it happens and there are still coho salmon, the salmon will return. If it happens and there's still, you know, 10 redwood trees, well, there might be more. So, like, the sooner that this happens, the more that there will be later for the rest of life and for the humans that come later. So they're not really going to care. Like, that we sat here and had this conversation, or what we thought about it all. They're going to care if there's food to eat, if they can drink the water and breathe the air, you know? And the sooner this comes down, the more there's going to be for those people in the future as well. I'm not answering your question, because I don't have any great ideas beyond, yeah, well, we got to get feminism everywhere, and, you know, these religions that say we got to, you know, go forth and multiply and dominate. I mean, it's just over, people. Like, it just didn't work as a plan, you know? We need a really different core story to our culture that's really about human humility and our participation. Really awestruck kind of, you know, know, humble participation in all these processes. But beyond that, it's like, yeah, well, a lot of work to do. It's you know, the best I can come up with. And not like the technology is that different. I mean, we all know how birth control works. And, you know, it's there. It's the cultures that are getting in the way.
That's mainly what you're talking about, just
knowledge
of birth control. But I knew about that. But that was a thing that you needed to tell me.
Yeah.
So I guess.
Well, it's like in some ways, it's like the whole culture has to shift, you know? Like, there's so many different institutions that really have to, like, the church, the family, the government, like, all these different things that right now are pushing us in one direction need to be going in the other way, which means we do need a different core story. But in the meantime, yeah, the planet's dying, so what now, you know? Guys.
Why do you seem a lot vegetarian? Why is this the vegetarian myth as opposed to just the myth of how everyone gets their food? Could you just say a little bit more?
Because
about
that? This is being held up as the thing that environmentalists should do, is eat this plant-based diet. And this is the way that we're going to save the world, is if we all just eat vegan, and it's not true. And I feel like the environmental movement are the only people who are going to face how bad the situation is on the planet, and this is the only solution we're being handed, is these personal lifestyle choices, especially diet. And that was what sucked me in when I was 16. It sounded really great. I was like, all right, I'm going to do my part. And it was wrong. I mean, agriculture is the worst thing we've done. So it's not going to save us. And we need to understand profoundly what we've done to this planet. So, I mean, I could call it the agriculture myth, but that's nobody's going to buy that. And, you know, I mean, there's basically four main chapters. So there's the moral vegetarians, political vegetarians, nutritional vegetarians. Okay, and so I go through, sort of, you know, one by one, all the different ways that people come at this and why they think this is going to save the planet, and why it's just not true, and why we need to understand at a much deeper level the kinds of human destructiveness that civilization has brought. So, I mean, I suppose it could be called the myth of civilization, too. But that's why I call it that. It's because this is really being held up as the way, the truth, the light, the way. Anybody else? Who you didn't speak yet, so why don't you go ahead, and then we'll take him.
Yeah, I just, kind of like an extension of that, I feel like eating only like factory farmed meat at the same, I mean, this is like going into just like the value stuff that you talked about at the very beginning, so we cannot really talk about this if you don't want to, but I feel like only eating like factory farmed meat and like fast food is definitely not better than being vegan.
No, I wouldn't
so,
say
like,
that.
I understand that like I despise like the green like movement and like the way it's like publicized as like the way you're talking about as far as like it'll save the planet by like going green and like being vegan or whatever, but like I feel like it could be a stepping stone, so like to call it a myth I think might, I don't know, I just feel like it's like downplaying like a lot of the bad shit that like a lot of vegans move away from when they become vegan. I don't know if I'm making sense.
You do, and I didn't call this the vegetarian lie.
Yeah.
You know, because really, those are the only values that are going to help.
Yeah.
And that's, and it's a very profound impulse, and it's a very powerful impulse when you decide, I don't want to be part of this torture and destruction anymore. And that was what motivated me. And it's a really important moment. And I want people to be motivated by that throughout their whole lives. And all I'm saying is we've been led astray. That this is not the plan to get us from A to B. And we need to be asking way deeper questions. That's why I called it the myth. Yeah. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. And then back there?
Uh-huh. I was just going to ask a question.
Good.
So essentially, it's not about agriculture. It's not about vegetarianism. It's not about, you know, overpopulation and resource depletion. It's essentially, your core argument is about cultural perceptions of the wider range of societies. Essentially, it's like how societies organize themselves and the trajectory that organization takes. So it's a cultural argument. It's a cultural problem, not a problem of resources or overpopulation. It's mainly one of culture, is basically what you're saying, if you want to boil down your argument to one term. So I'm just wondering if you'd say it that way. Because everything you said is essentially, when you get the ideas of values, you're talking about how society organizes itself and why it organizes itself in a certain way. So essentially, you're talking about culture. Like, what, when you talk about making a new story.
Yeah. Culture is only one part of it. I mean, like that transmission of values is definitely a core part of culture. But there's also the material institutions that
shape how people live their everyday lives. And at this point, I think that is the most important thing. Those institutions, because we're under such a time crunch, and because the stakes are so high. Like some, I mean, the reason I'm saying that is because so many people are like, well, if we just do this cultural work, you know, if we just make nice rituals and sing great songs and be nice to each other, whatever, that, you know, that's the work. And I actually don't agree. I think we need an actual political resistance movement to take this fucker down. So I would say, yeah, that is important, and we do need to change that story eventually. But there's concrete institutions that we need to be targeting to save the planet.
I don't know. You're divorcing the politics from culture. And I consider culture just everything that happens within,
okay,
you know, a society. So the politics of a culture is going to be influenced by its values.
Okay.
I mean, the political institutions are putting into direct action what
right.
a culture values.
Right.
So if we value the use of, say, SUVs, we're going to have, you know, institutions set up to pump oil out of the ground.
Sure.
So essentially, you are talking about a change of values. So
sure.
you are talking about changing the culture.
Right.
It's not like just changing institutions and reading the classics and getting the rituals, and it's basically what you value as a species, like what you value as a group of people. You know, if you value sustainability, you're going to, of course, alter those political institutions to meet those values. So I'm just wondering if, because you didn't necessarily address that, it's underlying all that argument. I mean, William Cotton and many other people, they basically, they're also talking about that
right.
without actually talking about it.
Okay.
So I'm just wondering if, because when you say we need a new story,
right.
and that's how you sum up, that's essentially creating a new culture.
Right.
So I'm just wondering if you see it as a cultural problem.
Sure. Yeah. But thank you. That's cool.
I'm just wondering.
Sure. Okay.
I guess first, I'm glad that you pointed out that it didn't necessarily have to be entitled Vegetarian Myth, that it could have been entitled Civilization and a lot of other things, and that the main point for Vegetarian Myth is that it sells the book more, so you can get better sales. But I think it's great that you're pointing out that bringing a lot of these things to light, that, you know, with our dependence upon grains in our society, and that people need to think, like the sign right there, think globally, act locally. They need
right.
to eat things locally and stuff. And although some of the other things you mentioned as far as, you know, population reduction, you know, that's a very important thing as far as being able to sustain societies. And the depletion of fossil fuels, it sounds a lot like a book by Jeremy Rifkin called The New Hydrogen Economy.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess my question is if a lot of the things you're talking about, you're not really putting a solution for us, forthcoming with a solution.
Well, okay,
what
one solution we could do right away. If we take all the agricultural land from the Mississippi to the eastern seaboard, and we put that back into prairie, the United States would immediately become a carbon sink. Immediately. Okay. Still driving SUVs, right? Still turning on our air conditioners all the time. That's all we have to do. So we need to reverse this process. You know, we've done nothing but destroy for 10,000 years. This would be the simplest thing in the world. This could be done. We could all start doing it, you know? And it's not even like on the, you know, nobody's even got up, mostly because of this. You know, like, it's not even an option.
Do you really think, though, that is a realistic option given today's civilization, just using the United States as an example? And then furthermore, I mean, from my understanding, it takes a lot more grain to feed animals to produce a pound of meat versus and what a person could eat as far as a pound of meat versus a pound of grain that you can grow.
Yeah,
so,
they,
I mean, do you go into discussing
grain,
the well, grains, grass, right, okay. So, but do you go into your book in discussing any of the numbers as far as how much
is... I've got like 300 pages on the numbers, but in fact, in a lot of climates, you're going to get way more calories per acre out of grass-fed beef than you ever will out of wheat. And it even takes less water.
The warming that's created
yeah.
from the methane gas from all the...
Well, the real problem with the methane is the permafrost melting. I mean, there were way more animals on this planet before agriculture, and there wasn't a global warming problem. I mean, you know, they're using it as a scapegoat. We need to restore those perennial polycultures. I mean, that's what we believe. If you took the beginning of agriculture to 1800, and then 1800 to now, you took that much carbon we've put into the atmosphere. We added that much from the beginning of agriculture to 1800. So it's a destructive process, you know, and we need to reverse it. So, I mean, the problem is, it's like, we want solutions that keep this way of life, but make it be okay, and there aren't any.
Well, I think we're really just realistic. Mm-hmm. I mean, making half the United States a prairie isn't anything that's going to happen in our lifetimes. I don't think that's a realistic solution.
Then we're all dead.
I'm sorry?
Then we're all dead.
Well, right, yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. So that's what I'm looking for is, do you pose any realistic solutions in your book? That's what my question is.
My realistic solution is that we need a resistance movement, a serious resistance movement.
And I heard that a lot, and I like that idea. Can you go about explaining the book, how people can go about doing that in the local community?
That's the book that I'm writing right now.
All
right. With my friend Derek Johnson and Eric McVeigh, and we may even have a publisher.
Okay.
And it's called Deep Green Resistance.
Okay.
But honestly,
that's
not that hard, because any resistance movement in the world goes after the same targets, infrastructure, okay? And honestly, gas, oil, electricity, internet, and you know the global capital, it's not that hard. All of these have vulnerable points. And again, if we were living in, you know, the Nazi fascists had come, we would know where to hit them. We're just not thinking in those terms because the left won't let us. The left said, eat this food, it'll all be fine, and it's bullshit. Okay? So, I'm a little tired of it, and that's why I'm writing the book that I'm writing now. So, alright.
You know, left, can you just say more about, is it that the left is saying it, or is that you don't think...
To me, it's like the left are the people who are supposed to be the resistance people. They're supposed to have an analysis of what's wrong with the world and why power is hurting us and how these hierarchies evolved and what we're going to do about it. And so, ultimately, the aim is always to create a movement, because it's always, power never gives up without some kind of force, without some kind of demand, without serious action from the ground. And the left is, are supposed to be the people who care about that. The right is certainly not going to care about it. So if we're the people who care about justice, and we're the people who care about the planet, why are we being told buy this instead of this as a solution? It's not a solution. Okay, we need way, 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 way bigger solutions. You know, they have to encompass the entire problem. And the problem, as I see it, is not to have industrial culture, but make it a little bit nicer, because that's actually never going to work. It really needs to stop. And so we can't save this way of life. Is what I'm, and they keep trying, like all the mainstream environmentalists, we're going to save this way of life, but we're going to have green cars. Well, cars are actually the problem. I mean, it takes 3 times more energy to produce a car than you will ever use by driving it. Cars destroy human culture. What they need is completely opposite of what human beings need. So there's all these ways that, like, cars are never going to work for this, you know? Oh, well, we can make these different solar cells. But have you ever heard of iridium or galladium? These are necessary minerals to make, you know, PVC cells. We're already out of them, but they're already so rare that we're about to start fighting, you know, battles over them in Africa. Like, we cannot do this, people. We can't save this way of life. It's so over. And that's what nobody will say on the left. Now, they're always trying to fix the problem with, like, the silver bullet. We're going to have a new kind of energy economy. You know, it's like biofuels. Well, it takes more energy to produce them than you're ever going to get out of them. Like, we keep being handed these completely bogus solutions because they won't face the real problem, which is that industrial civilization will never be sustainable. And that's what nobody's saying. And, you know, I'm sorry I'm getting a little bit upset, but it's like, the planet is dying. And somebody has to say it out loud.
So I guess what it kind of comes down to is hunter-gatherer versus agriculture.
Yeah, or horticulturalist, I would say. You could do agriculture, you could do hunter-gatherer, you've got the coastal people who can pretty much live in place, because those environments should be so rich that you can just scoop up some fish and you're good. And people, you know, live that way for millions of years too. And then the horticulturalists have a little more impact on their environment, but they're still mostly based on perennials, and they're not doing, you know, broad-scale clearing of their land. Even if they only do a little bit here and there in the forest, it's such a small population density, it doesn't really matter, and it's mostly based on perennials.
What about herding?
He's a pastoralist, so let's get into those. Pastoralists, they can do fine, because again, anything that's based on perennial permacultures, you've got a shot. Any of this can be done badly. I don't mean to say that automatically you're going to do it. And the moment you've got population pressures, the pastoralists, you know, they're overgrazing everywhere. You know, it's like, the Mediterranean looks like shit because of, you know, there's too many goats. Well, there's too many people. So, you know, it's like anything can be done badly. But the only chance that we have is if it's based on perennial polycultures. So I would say the hunter-gatherers, the fishing coastal people, the pastoralists, and some of the horticulturalists have pretty well had that down. You know, even if it took them a few thousand years to kind of settle in, okay, but... Yeah.
There's also a sample that I've read. It's called Future Primitive. I don't know if you've read.
Oh yeah, it's right here.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Man.
Is that Kevin Parker?
I'm not really sure, but it pretty much goes into the development of our culture from a hunter-gatherer society into agriculture.
Right, right.
And it's very interesting. And like when we were like. I guess you could say that our agricultural society and the power structures that we have set up, like,
right.
you know, our governments and everything like that are not compatible with a hunter-gatherer society.
Well, they're not,
yeah,
because most hunter-gatherers live in somewhere between 15 to 75 people. Past that point, human interactions one-on-one tend to break down.
Yeah.
And it's not that they don't have larger tribal affiliations, but I'll kind of on a day-to-day basis. So most decision-making is made kind of face-to-face. And past that point, I mean, even today, if you've got that many people in a room, it's really, really hard because there's just too many relationships. So it's not until you get people living in these really densely populated areas that you need things like law, because you're trying to negotiate between strangers. And most of those relationships are going to be based on contract. So that means that they're really about commercial relationships. So right away, you've taken what should be human relationships embedded in lifelong lifelong connections between people, and it's turned into these, you know, structures of hierarchy that are based on abstract notions of right and wrong, people making decisions about your life that you've never met before, and usually it starts with the commercial exchange. So, you know, there's capitalism for you. We see how friendly that is. So, yeah, no, I think it's pretty sure this is Kevin Tucker. Yeah. Yeah.
Is Kevin Tucker also
Yes, species trainer, that's Kevin.
Yeah, I met that guy. He's from Western Pennsylvania.
He's in Pittsburgh, right? He's up there somewhere.
Yeah, I live in Greensburg, and he was from, I think, that town.
Uh-huh.
And I think he does, like, a skateboarding company, too.
Oh, does he? No, he was called up before the grand jury for one of the green scares, and he didn't say a word.
So whatever else we may think or know about Kevin Tucker, he held his ground.
Yeah.
And
we
need to say that over and over. He didn't snitch. He said nothing that he knew. He could have gone to jail, and he held the line. So we'll give Kevin Tucker an A+ on that one.
Yeah, he's a really nice dude.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Well, thank you all for coming. Yay.
Thank you. Feel free to hang out if you want a book. You can get it signed even.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'll sign a book.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I should have asked you.
Oh, yeah, good idea.
They're hungry.
They are
hungry
out
there. So it went from what, $57?
Oh.
So it's $4 an hour.
That's a lot of quarters you got to drive out.
They always have these little skinny fries.